Good evening, everyone. I hope that you are well fed and well prepared to feast further. It's my privilege to welcome you here tonight and to receive you into this fellowship. I see mainly church members, but there's some guests with us, and we're glad to have you with us as well. I would like to say just a word about the Judy Matthews lectureship and then turn the microphone to Lee so that he can properly introduce Billy Abraham. Judy had a wonderful experience as she was directing the education ministries in this church because she was able to grow herself by going to Perkins School of Theology and to work on her certification as a Christian educator. And there she was exposed to brilliant professors and leaders in the church. And through that exposure, had a vision that people of that presence and caliber could be brought to the local church so that many could benefit from that quality of leadership. So in Judy's memory and in honor of her ministry, this lectureship was founded, and through its founding, the desire was to engender that spirit and keep it alive and to let that ministry carry forward into the future that is now the present. So how many years has this been going on, Lee? This is the 12th year, and many fine people have come, but I'll let Lee say more about that. It was my privilege to be there at the beginning of that, and to come back tonight and to enjoy this fellowship tonight with you is a second blessing. So we look forward to hearing from Dr. Abraham tonight. And Lee, let me turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you, Richard. Thank y'all so much for being here tonight. It means an awful lot to me. First, I'd like to thank the Covenant class for providing the supper tonight. Give them a big hand. And tomorrow night, there'll be another meal. Tony Mamula is in charge of that, her Sunday school class. So come back for another good meal tomorrow night and listen to the rest of the lecture. I really don't know what to say about Dr. Abraham. You know, if I cut it short, then it doesn't do him justice. And if I take the long route, then it'd be longer than the lecture. He's really, really looking at his CV, just really a tremendous scholar. A lot of experience. He was born in Ireland, and you know, raised there and went to school. He's graduated from Northern Ireland. What is it? Inniskillen and Port Royal School. He's also gotten a degree in divinity from Asbury Theological Society Seminary in the United States. And a philosophy of religion from Oxford in England. And he'll correct me on anything I'm wrong on here. So, but I was looking through. He's also currently the Albert Cook Outler Professor of Wesley Studies at Perkins School. And Wesley is one of his specialties and areas of interest. He's also the Altshuler University Distinguished Teacher at SMU. So very highly recognized and distinguished teacher. But I was going through his CV just to see what all he had done. And he has published 17 books, written 75 articles, has done 17 book reviews, 85 lectures and presentations. Just, golly, you know, he's a few weeks younger than I am, but he's done about 100 times things more. So I don't think I could ever keep up with him. And just in talking with him and coming from the airport and to hear just some of the things that he's still interested in and still doing, it's just a pace that it'd be hard to keep up with. So, but for the topic tonight, terrorism and theology in Islam, Dr. Abraham is especially qualified to talk about that, being born and raised in Ireland, that experience. So he'll start off talking a little about that and then relate it to the terrorism we're seeing today in the Islam community. So I think it'll be very interesting, a topic that I think we're all interested in this time in our society when we see, you know, threats and we don't understand really, you know, why it's happening and why people can, you know, do something terroristic and say it's in the name of God or something like that. So hopefully he'll give us some opinions and shed some light on that. Dr. Abraham.
Well, we've got a full house tonight. There's a lot of pressure on up here. And it's a great pleasure to leave the, what shall I call it, the high living and low thinking up there in Dallas and come down here to the delights of Houston. I've been 30 years in Texas. It's hard to believe. And I left Ireland to get out of the rain. And it works. It does. It works. And I love this part of the world, and I love the United States, even though I've got an Irish passport and I've got a British passport. My name is Abraham, and I'm thoroughly confused. Now, the topic is one. Thank you, Lee, for that marvelous introduction. And it's a pleasure to be here to honor Judy, your dear wife, in the past, and to be part of this group here in this church. Now, the topic is a very sobering one, and I got into it in part for two reasons. One was, I'm convinced that a lot of secular treatments of terrorism don't know how to handle the issue of theology and religion. So, the second issue is that coming out of Ireland, I thought I was going to escape all of this. Until after 9/11. And so over the years, I've been keeping a close eye on this and working on this topic. And so what I'd like to do tonight is to sort of, in many ways, compare and contrast the situation in Ireland and the situation in radical Islam. And then tomorrow night, I'm not sure where I'm going to go, depending on if you show up again. But there are very interesting spiritual issues around terrorism. One of them, for example, is the whole problem of forgiveness. So if you lose dear ones in terrorist bombings, how do you handle the anger and the rage and the call to forgiveness and reconciliation? The other issue, and I haven't decided which of these I'm going to go with, the other issue I'll pick up tomorrow night would be potentially, what kind of evil are we up against? And how do we think about that as Christians? So I'll pray overnight and see what the Lord tells me. Now I want to begin with what happened on 9/11. I know that that's a sore spot for many people, but I want to begin there. On the night before 9/11, 19 Islamist terrorists affiliated with Al-Qaeda began their preparations for their work the next day. They had done all the standard kind of things that terrorists have to do to get ready for a murderous operation. They'd gone through rigorous training and rigorous indoctrination. Now, by the way, by terrorism, I mean the use of terror against innocent civilians in order to achieve political purposes. Okay? Now, if you're going to go after innocent civilians and kill them, it's very hard for human beings to do that. So you have to be rigorously trained, and you've got to be really seriously indoctrinated. They had selected their targets, worked out the details of the impending operation with precision, and gone over the final minutiae together. Now they were down to the very last items. They check their IDs, their passports, and their papers. They removed excess hair from their bodies, took a shower, and sprayed themselves with perfume. They examined their bags and their clothes, especially their socks and shoes. They checked their weapons, making sure that their knives were properly sharpened. They steeled their mind once more for what they were going to do the next day. They knew that they would have to tame their emotions, that they would have to be very patient in meeting resistance, and be very disciplined in listening and obeying. They searched their hearts, ridding themselves of all their worldly ambitions. Now, in and through these preparations, they drew on the manifold resources of their faith. Prayer accompanied every step. They asked God in the middle of the night and many times thereafter for victory. They prayed for the forgiveness for their sins and for any extravagance in their work to date. The latter perhaps included forgiveness for attendance at strip clubs. No doubt a strategy to deter detection if it was not a means of anticipating future sensual bliss. As they went to work, they prayed for the overpowering of the enemy, for facilitation of the operation, for protective covering, for their souls, for the knives, for the details of the taxi journey to go expeditiously, for blindness on the part of airport personnel, for patience, and for peace on entering the aircraft. They asked for firmness as they clenched their teeth in battle. They asked for God to be present with them in the cutting of throats and for help in opening their jackets and chests in welcoming death. And they also requested the ability to smile through it all. They read and pondered crucial chapters of the Quran. They reviewed the chapters on the spoils of war and repentance of the Holy Quran. They recalled that God had said that they should not dispute among themselves, and that many small groups can defeat a big one if God permits. They noted again that God was mightier than all his creation, that the devil makes his agents afraid, and that they should hit their adversaries over their necks and on every finger, that there should be no prisoners of war until the enemy is weakened, and above all, that there is no God but Allah. Thus they immersed themselves in the true and final revelation that God had given to the world. It was salutary and sufficient to rely on the word of the Lord. They remembered and savored relevant doctrines at the heart of Islam. God is the God of all creation. So he had created them for a purpose, and they can depend upon God. Angels were there to guard them and make supplication for them. God is a God of providence. He can make a dam for them before their fronts and their backs. No devices, doors, or technology have any benefit in slaughter unless God permits it. God can weaken the tricks of the disbelievers. God is a God of grace and salvation. Those who say that there is no God but Allah, believing it with all their heart, they enter paradise. They will pass through the judgment, and the most beautiful women in paradise will receive them. Paradise has already been decorated with the best of its decorations and ornaments, and the most beautiful women already call them to come, and they have dressed in the best of their attire for them. Now you may wonder where we get all this information. We actually get it in a letter left behind by those who were involved in the attack on 9/11. Now the whole world knows what happens next. They took over four commercial aircraft, used them as flying bombs, most dramatically in the case of the World Trade Center. Each of the jet airliners had a fuel capacity of 24,000 US gallons. And by the time it was all over, the 19 hijackers, along with 2,973 people, were dead. Another 24 were missing and presumed dead. Hundreds were killed instantly. 200 jumped to their death from burning towers. 400 rescue workers died when buildings collapsed on top of them. Those who died came from 62 different countries, 250 from India, 200 from Pakistan, 200 from Britain, 55 from Australia, and 23 from Japan. There was among them a Barbie doll collector, a Palestinian accountant, an ex-hippie stockbroker, a Japanese hockey player, a vegetarian calligrapher, and an Ecuadorian sous chef. The number who died was comparable to the total number who died in the north of Ireland since the 1970s. It was 600 more than the number at Pearl Harbor on December the 7th, 1941, and 30 times greater than the number killed in the Oklahoma City bombing on April 19th, 1995. Now, in my reading of the history of terrorism, and in many ways I operate as a layperson here. As a theologian and philosopher, I operate as a theologian and philosopher. But like you, you know, we read the press and we do our homework. And so I don't say that I'm an expert on terrorism. I just pay attention. My own conviction is that terrorist groups are like snowflakes. From a distance, they look the same. Up close, they're radically different. Of course, for the victims and their relatives, these differences are cold comfort, for the impact is the same. The victims have been killed or injured, their relatives are left to mourn and to work through their grief. However, terrorist acts are as specific as the causes they represent, the personalities that perform them, the motives that drive them, and the context in which they take place. That's why it's crucial when you deal with terrorist organizations to stay close to the ground and work through the questions that bother us case by case, comparison by comparison, and disanalogy by disanalogy. And nowhere is this truer than we try to understand the relationship between religion and terrorism, or between theology and terrorism. We can see immediately that religion and terrorism, indeed theology and terrorism, are intimately connected in the case of Al-Qaeda. And this is radically different from the Irish situation. Now, it's not that there are just no records of Irish terrorists that display the religious commitment and sensibility clearly on display in the case of the 9/11 terrorists. The fact of the matter is this: in Ireland, terrorism is driven by nationalism. Now, Scott Pelley, by the way, who's a United Methodist, missed this a couple of nights ago, or maybe a couple of weeks ago, in dealing with Gerry Adams and what's happening in the north of Ireland. And I could take a whole lecture on this, but I won't. What happened in Ireland is that we have the sort of leftovers of the wars of religion of the Reformation. By the way, we used to kill each other regularly. One of the nice things about Methodists is we never killed anybody. The government wouldn't let us. And effectively, as Ireland became de-Christianized, as it's currently the case, what you get is that your religious identity is morphed over into an ethnic and nationalist identity. So I'll not bore you with all the details here, but I was brought up as a Protestant, but anti-Christian. It takes some wrapping your mind around that, huh? Because to be Protestant was to be, quote, pro-British. It was to be part of the United Kingdom. And we were very clear. Jesus was just a bit of a nuisance. Stay clear of him. He gets in your hair and gets you to do things you don't want to do. And so what you get in Ireland, I just put this briefly, are really rival forms of nationalism, which go back 400 years. Ireland was the first colony of the British Empire. And basically what happened after complications not get into here, but the British government moved over, the English British government moved over people from Scotland and from England and from London into the north of Ireland, and they colonized the north of Ireland. And they brought with them their religion. So Derry or Londonderry, actually, if you say Derry, you're a Catholic. If you say Londonderry, you're a prod. That's how deep this thing runs. Huh? And so what happened was that it was the first colony of the British Empire. And then over the years, after all, what, Texans have been in Texas for 400 years? So the people in the north say, we're British. The people who are Irish nationalists says, you're interlopers. You shouldn't be here. You get out of here. You're on my backyard. You're on my soil. We'll kill you if you don't get out. And the response is, we've been in Texas longer than the Texans have been in Texas. And we're not leaving. And if you start killing us, we'll start killing you. So terrorism in the north of Ireland is basically and fundamentally nationalistic in orientation. Now, again, it would take longer to unpack this, but I'll just say another word about this. What's interesting, if you're a Catholic terrorist, can I use that language? No, I'll back off. If you're an Irish nationalist terrorist, a Republican terrorist, you come out of the Catholic tradition. You've got a lot more religious practices and symbols and whatnot that you can sort of secularize and use for your nationalist orientation. So you can sort of tell the story of Ireland as the story of Easter, Good Friday and Easter, Easter rising. And you can get all this magnificent iconography on the walls. And you can make saints out of bombers and killers. So the really tricky part is if you come out of the Catholic tradition and you've abandoned your Christianity, right? You can use the leftover materials out of your religious tradition, its practices, its narratives, its symbols, its iconographic practices. And what you do is you simply slide your nationalism into all that material. It's very powerful. Now, interesting, on the Protestant side, on the Loyalist side, it's quite different. There, the terrorists are smitten with Puritan guilt. And there are two ways out of a terrorist organization on the Loyalist side. You can either go feet first, and you can imagine what that is, or you get converted, and you get born again, and you find Jesus. And there's this residue of Presbyterian awe before the Almighty, in which you can leave the terrorist organization and they won't come after you because of the residue of the Presbyterian tradition in the north of Ireland. It's amazing. I once interviewed one of the leading terrorists in the north of Ireland, actually. And I had a group of students with me, Perkins students, who were superb. They'd done the homework. It was brilliant. And we got him to let his hair down. And we got to the point where I said, you know, did you ever pray about what you were doing? Very poignant question. Now, this is a man who'd kill people, train people to kill civilians, kneecapping people. This is a thug. You fool yourself. So he looked at me and he said, well, Billy, he said, I did. I said, well, what did you pray? He said, I talked to God. And I told God what I was going to do. And then I said to God, after it's all over, you can do whatever you like with me. In other words, if this sends me to hell, that's perfectly okay with me. Now, I could take a lot longer to unpack what I'm getting at here. This is a crucial contrast between the Irish situation and what I'm going to argue in the next 10, 15 minutes in the case of radical Islam. In Ireland, our terrorists are driven by nationalism. You have Irish nationalists who want a united Ireland, an all-Ireland republic, who want the border between the north and the south to go away. And you have loyalist terrorists, so-called loyalist terrorists, by the way, who are never seen in church. That's the one thing you can be sure they're not where they are. And both of them, they are what you might call British nationalists. They say, we've been born British, we're Northern Irish, but we're British, and we're going to be buried British, and we are going to die British, and if you stop us being British, we'll kill you. So the issue of religion is either not really seriously present, as I think is the case on the Protestant side, on the loyalist side, or what you're doing is that you're using what I would call the leftovers of the Catholic tradition, after you really don't believe it in any serious way. You're using the patterns of thinking, you're using the iconographic traditions, you're using, you know, Catholics have saints. Well, we'll get our saints. We'll make a few saints out of these people. And so you recycle, the way I put it, you recycle fundamentally the materials and practices and persons, if you like, of the Catholic tradition into your narrative of Irish nationalism. Now, I want to say that when you're dealing with the case of the folk on 9/11, here we're dealing with a case where the relationship between terrorism and theology is intimate, where the theology is providing a rationale, where it's providing a motivation, where it's providing a grounding for terrorist activities. Consider the fatwa that was issued on the 23rd of February 1998. Fatwa, I'll come to this in a moment, is like a papal bull. Now, we Methodists don't have things like this because our General Conference, we'd never listen to it. I mean, General Conference can say all we like, but we'll make up our own minds about it. All right. The ruling to kill the Americans and their allies, civilians and military, is an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do so. In order to liberate the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Holy Mosque from their grip, and in order for their armies to move out of all lands of Islam, defeated and unable to threaten any Muslim. This is in accordance with the word of Almighty Allah, quote, and fight the pagans all together as they fight you all together, and fight until there is no more tumult or oppression, and there prevails justice and faith in Allah. Now, this is a legal pronouncement. And the crucial issue then, what do we make of that? In my judgment, it fulfills the conventional rules for a fatwa. It was in line with the relevant legal proofs derived from the Quran and the Hadith in Islam. It was issued by those who have appropriate knowledge and sincerity of heart. It was free from individual opportunism and not dependent on political servitude. And it was relative to the needs of the contemporary world. Those are the kind of criteria that go into delineating what a fatwa is. Now, it's not going to help here to simply say, well, there's no magisterium in Islam which can give you a legitimate ruling. Of course there isn't. It's only in Roman Catholicism that you have this very tightly organized system. In Islam, it's much more open. The conditions for determining an authentic fatwa are relatively sort of contested. So fatwa do not have to meet some sort of alien standard brought over out of Roman Catholicism to be valid. And I think there are very, very good reasons, not just for accepting this as a fatwa, but also for seeing it as a very significant fatwa. Here are four of them. For one thing, the source is secure. The fatwa in question was issued by the hand of Osama bin Laden, a man who was considered to be a hero within much of the worldwide Muslim community. Bin Laden was a devout Muslim whose faith was sincere and entirely consonant with the general practices, in some respects, of Sunni Islam. Indeed, for many, he was the paradigm of a good Muslim, gladly abandoning a life of luxury and wealth to serve the cause of Islam. It conspicuously exhibited the Muslim virtues of moral outrage, self-sacrifice, otherworldliness, and brotherhood. Second, the reception of the fatwa is secure. Bin Laden had secured the affection and allegiance of many Muslims across the world, and they were very, very glad to accept his rulings. He may have hidden away in a cave in the Tora Bora, but he was not an isolated figure. Mothers named their children after him. His face was an icon of the true piety. His video and writings commanded avid attention. Most importantly, he was able to recruit an army of fighters in his own militant organization who were more than ready to take him as their teacher and their leader. And beyond that, he was a source of inspiration and hope for many ordinary Muslims and for a host of militant Muslim terrorist groups. We can come briefly to ISIS at the end. Third, the fatwa fits with a serious reading of the Islamic traditions. Bin Laden was able to claim legitimately a deep resonance with elements in the Islamic tradition that had been brilliantly worked out across the centuries. Thus, they have continuities with the work of crucial figures in the 13th and 14th century in their call to armed resistance, with the Wahhabi tradition in Saudi Arabia in the 18th century, with the remarkable Indian thinker Al-Madudi, and with the amazing Egyptian theologian Sayyid Qutb. Now, I'll do a parenthesis here. Qutb's a very interesting figure. Qutb is really the theologian of Al-Qaeda. Brought up in Egypt, he wanted to be a poet and writer. He became a teacher, was sent to the United States. He ended up in Colorado and ended up at a dance in a United Methodist or Methodist church in Colorado, which didn't exactly endear him to the West. In other words, when he was in the United States, he came to believe, actually, that the West was decadent. He went back to Egypt, made connections with the Muslim Brotherhood, very important group, and over time wrote a 13-volume commentary on the Quran. Passages of this, parts of this has been published, and you can as a manifesto. And to read it is to actually, it's a combination, I would say, of fascism, let's say probably picked up from Europe and Hitler and company, and maybe also from Lenin, who knows, and revivalistic literature. Now, if you read 19th century revivalistic literature, it's very interesting material. So it's a combination of sort of hot Muslim gospel and sort of deep judgments directed at the failures of Islam in the Islamic countries, the leaders of Islam, to be properly and fully Muslim. And it's the third component. It's got this really sharp, powerful edge. As I was saying to Lee, I moonlight as with my own missionary organization in Romania and in Nepal. That's another story. I'm tempted to send around a hat, actually, with a group of Methodists like this, but I'll not do it. I was in Kathmandu about 10 years ago and ran into this wonderful Muslim salesman. I had a beard. My name is Abraham, and it was tea every night after that. And after a while, he wanted to convert me. So he started bringing me material from the mosque. Now, I had my book on evangelism with me too, my Logic of Evangelism book, so I was prepared to do a swap, right? Here's what I discovered. I discovered that he brought me the writings of Qutb. And I thought, wow, in Kathmandu of all places. And I wanted, actually, there was one of the books that I didn't have. I wanted to bring it back to Texas with me, and he wouldn't give it to me because he wouldn't steal it from the library. I would have had no compunction of stealing a book from the library. Of course, being, you know. So anyway, I get back to Dallas. And I had a friend who was working with one of the Dallas newspapers. And I was telling him the story, just blarney in a way like I normally do. He said, that's nothing. He said, they're reading Qutb in the mosque in Richardson. I said, I don't believe a word of it. I don't believe a word of it. He said, send me your fax number. And he says, I'll give you the curriculum. I'll send you the curriculum. And the curriculum included for the group of the teenagers that they were reading Qutb. Now, I recommend that you get a hold of this stuff yourself. The book is called, there's two titles for the book. It's called Milestones or Signposts. And if you Google it, you'll be able to buy it.
Spell the name of the author.
Qutb. Thank you. Q for question, U for umbrella, T for tea and biscuits, and B for Bobby. Qutb. Now, what I want to get at here, this is why I think this is a significant fatwa that I quoted earlier, because it fits in there's a whole stream of Islam. Now, we're going to come back later, and we're going to have to ask how representative is that. But it's a stream that took off in the 13th century, was developed in Saudi Arabia in the 18th century, and sort of revived in the most powerful way imaginable, in my judgment, in Egypt, in fact, in the 1950s and 60s. Qutb eventually, by the way, was he was executed by Nasser. So there's a real theology behind this stuff. Further, the fatwa can, without due awkwardness, be encoded within a narrative of Islamic history that is internally persuasive. Thus, for some Muslims, it coheres nicely with the vision of Islam committed to recapturing Muslim homelands. Because once you convert a people, then that country legitimately belongs to Islam. Ridding the Islamic holy sites of foreign troops. Eliminating Israel. Restoring the caliphate. And spreading the truth of Islam as a religious and political ideology across the world. Now, bin Laden, in fact, readily appealed to the practice of jihad to underwrite terrorist acts. As he sees it, the presence of American troops in the holiest of places, the massacres of Iraqis in the First Gulf War, and the support of the Jews' petty state, quote-unquote, these constitute, quote, a clear declaration of war on Allah, his messenger, and Muslims. Muslims have throughout the Islamic history unanimously agreed that jihad, struggle against evil, is an individual duty if the enemy destroys Muslim countries. Hence, bin Laden carefully grounds his fatwa in a central concept of Islamic theology and practice. And it is jihad that provides the grounds for the fatwa to kill all Americans, civilians and military, and their allies in any country in which it is possible to do so. Now, the closest analogies with this, and I'm not going to develop this with any great detail, the closest analogy here is with the Crusaders. Now, the story of the Crusaders is a complicated one, but the bottom line is this, is that you engaged in Crusades for theological reasons. So you're grounding it and motivating it in religion and in theology. You got similar considerations in the post-Reformation periods as well. I mean, there were lots of hairy groups after the Reformation. I mean, civil war in England, some people got it into their heads that God had told them that they ought to cut off the head of the king. That's why John Locke actually wrote his book on philosophy. His essay on human understanding is really a debate about whether you know you've got a divine revelation on your hands or not. Most secular readings of Locke don't see that. So there are instances of, in the Christian tradition, where in certain stretches, we have appealed to theology for violent acts of terrorism, violent acts against those that we disagree with. So in this respect, in a sense, as you probably noticed, it looks as if we're with the arrival of Islamist terrorism, we're actually turning the clock back and having to deal with something that we've not had to deal with for centuries. I think really one of the deep problems of this whole issue, as I mentioned at the beginning, is that we've lost the ability to read religious texts. We've lost the ability to read theological texts. And because we've become so secularized, we don't see it. As a parallel to this, one of the big mistakes that was made in Britain was that when various Muslim groups arrived from Pakistan and Bangladesh and whatnot, the only identity that the politicians could perceive was that of class. These people are poor, they belong to the working class. They never recognized that, in fact, these folk were serious about their religion. And the result was that they were never assimilated into the culture. And so they put their heads down, they did all the dirty work that nobody else would do. And then a second generation comes around and says, we're not going to put up with this any longer. And then they become actually very vulnerable to radical figures who say that the Islam represented by their parents is a kind of third-rate version. They need to get a hot version. They need to get real Islam. And so the difficulty of secularization, which is well covered in a host of body of literature, the problem with secularization is secular people forget. They no longer know how to read theological and religious texts. This is true of my own profession, by the way, in philosophy itself. I was taught in reading Descartes and Locke and Kant and all these people. Don't pay any attention whatsoever to the religious convictions. That's just fluff. That's just sort of window dressing in order to get a hearing. When in actual fact, you cannot understand people like Descartes or Locke or all of these major figures in the Enlightenment if you don't understand that they were driven by a crisis that was emerging in Western Christianity. That's another story I'll not bore you with here. So what I want to get at here, what I'm driving at here, is that I see an intimate connection between the Islamist the terrorists represented by Al-Qaeda, I think they're the classic case, and in fact, very particular brand and stream of the Muslim tradition. So for example, just to bring this section to a close, bin Laden did not see his position as a sort of idiosyncratic. He didn't think that he was a crackpot outside the mainstream of the Islamic tradition. He says, these young men that have sacrificed themselves in New York and Washington, these are the ones that speak the truth of the conscience of our people. And they are its living conscience, which sees that it is imperative to take revenge against these evildoers and transgressors and criminals and terrorists who terrorize the true believers. So not all terrorism, he says, is restrained or ill-advised. Notice this. There is terrorism that is ill-advised, and there is terrorism that is a good act. So in the definition of the word, if a criminal or a thief feels that he's terrorized by the police, do we label the police terrorists and say they terrorized the thief? No. The terrorism of the police towards the criminals is a good act. And the terrorism that's being exercised by the criminals against the true believers is wrong and ill-advised. So America and Israel practice ill-advised terrorism, and we practice, this is the chilling comment, we practice good terrorism because it deters those from killing our children in Palestine and other places. I think that's a clincher quotation. I do not see how any Christian could ever say that the use of terror directed at innocent civilians for political purposes, I don't see that any Christian could ever say that that was a good act. And what you see here is that this is being claimed very clearly as a good act. Now, last part of this lecture. Is this or is it representative of Islam as a whole? Absolutely not. It is a minority report. For one thing, Muslim leaders across the world have publicly and repeatedly repudiated the vision and action of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Thus, in the wake of 9/11, hundreds of Muslim leaders, scholars, converts, and institutes made abundantly clear that they totally rejected the killing of innocent civilians in New York and elsewhere. The murders of 9/11 were dismissed as gross crimes, sinful acts, and shameless evils. They were totally rejected as cowardly, deserving condemnation, treasonous, suicidal, unjustifiable, and barbaric. The president of Iran wrote at the time, "The September 11 terrorists in America can only be the job of a group that have voluntarily severed their own ears and tongues, so that the only language with which they could communicate would be destroying and spreading death." Those who kill innocent civilians are roundly condemned as having deviant beliefs and misleading ideologies. They are acting counter to the humanitarian values of Islam. They do not understand Islam, have no other faculty except ignorance and hatred. They do not reflect Islamic beliefs, Muslim beliefs and practice. Put it more broadly, the leaders have said these are murderers, terrorists, extremists, radicals, and fundamentalists who have inflicted a horrible scar on the history of Islam and humanity. Further, bin Laden's defense of terrorism is repudiated by the classical teaching of Islam and the practice of war. Now, Islam considers war a duty under certain conditions. You can go to war in order to promote the advancement of Muslim power. However, the relevant factors for the current issue have to do with the conditions for waging war. Not with the conditions for waging war, but with the clear injunctions on the conduct of war. Thus, the killing of innocents is not allowed, nor is the wanton destruction of livestock, animals, orchards, trees, and wells. The tradition of restraint runs all the way from Muhammad right up to the present, and it is the central teaching of Islam across space and time, across its divisions past and present. Not even the famous sword text can be stretched to cover acts of terrorism. The harshest text in Islam clearly confines the injunction to the kill to idolatrous. It does not extend the killing to innocent civilians. The judgment that bin Laden and his cohorts are not mainstream Muslims is confirmed by the language that has now become commonplace. Thus, he is systematically described as a radical, and his vision of Islam is now conventionally referred to as Islamism rather than simply Islam. It belongs to the wider diversity that has long been the case within the history of Islam, and it stands at the polar opposite of the vision of reformed or liberal Islam that is now being vigorously pursued as a live option within the West. Radical Islam is, of course, a live option, but it is a live option alongside other versions of Islam. Now, it's difficult sometimes for mainstream Muslims, becoming less difficult as the years go on, for them to get this message out, that this, what they're dealing with is a minority report and a significant stream as a minority report, but I think the truth of the matter is patently clear. Radical Islam is not mainstream Islam. Now, I think this is very good news. Now, the bad news, of course, is that terrorist groups will always be a minority in a bigger majority. In the Irish situation, at its worst, in the north, we had about 500 terrorists. Their fanaticism was deep and protracted, but it had a bottom line. The fanaticism of Muslim terrorists has no bottom line, but because it is grounded in faith and divine revelation. Hence, it is no difficulty in reworking suicide bombers into martyrs who gladly take on the task of killing innocent civilians. The closest that we came to this in Ireland were what was known as murder bombs. In this instance, the terrorists would kidnap a family, strap the male head of the family into a van full of explosives, threaten to kill the rest of his family if he didn't drive it to the chosen target, and then they detonated the bomb when he arrived at it, killing the driver in the process. Of course, the terrorists went home that night to eat their supper and play with the dog. There was no question of their committing suicide. In the case of radical Islam, this was taken one step further. Here, terrorists are fully prepared to kill themselves to kill others, and they can legitimately profess the first order language of religion, as we've said here, the language of martyrdom. Now, let me sort of pull this to a close here. I have a lot more, but let me pull it to a close here. I think about Islam in this way. There's the radicals over here who are minority. And the change with ISIS is interesting. I would say the changes that have emerged now with this group called ISIS are, what shall I say, they're several. One, they have a caliphate. That's to say they have a land, which is very important for Muslims, right? That gives them a beachhead, and of course, if they're not able to hold that, this is going to be a very serious blow to them. Because after the fall of the caliphate, the radical Islam has wanted to have land, really. They have mastered the internet and the public relations machine. They've really done that. They have figured out how to recruit particularly restless, vulnerable young people, including young women, and they have turned against Christians, as we know. Now, I think that they're simply a more sort of, they're an extended version of what I've been arguing here. So you have one group, which is a version of radical Islam, which is a minority report. It's got a history, right? Reaching right back into the 13th century. That's one group. Now, the second group is what I would call mainstream Islam, Sunni and Shia. And they're the ones that very clearly are saying, we do not agree whatsoever with what's going on in radical Islam. And this is a very, very important development. Wall Street Journal, a couple of Fridays ago, had a superb editorial by the head of the Muslim University in Cairo in Egypt. And in no uncertain terms did the head of the university there say that ISIS and their cousins have absolutely no grounds whatsoever for claiming Muslim identity or to be claiming to be Muslim exegetes of the Quran. This is a very important development. Jordan also, the leadership in Jordan have stepped up. The Saudi Arabians have stepped up, and they're in a difficult situation. So what I want to get at here, you've got mainstream Islam. Now, that poses a very interesting question for Christians, because they do not accept the separation of religion and politics. The very simple heartfelt thesis at the heart of it. How do you rule a country? By divine law. I mean, are you going to go with human opinion when you've got the law of God given in the Quran? Of course not. So this cuts at the very heart of the American experiment in the way in which you've figured out a way to deal with religion and politics. Religion is a very nasty business. It's sometimes very bad for your intellectual health. Right? And it's sometimes poison and toxic in the public, in the political arena, And you Americans, this will be another lecture, you've worked out a very interesting sort of system in which you didn't go away the way of Britain and you didn't go the way of France, but you figured out a way in which you would sort of let religious talk into the public square, but you said, thus far, no further. But Islam challenges that at the very foundations. Because it says we must, in the end, for the most part, in mainstream Islam, we must have a theocracy. We must have the divine law embodied in the jurisprudence, in the educational system, in the family law, and so on and so forth. Right? Now, the third group that I want to draw attention to is Reform Islam. Now, what you've got here are it's a minority report. So you have two minority reports on the other side here. And the core issue here is this, that the Quran is to be reinterpreted by experts, exegetes, and scholars, not by your local imams. And so what's emerged is a network of scholars. One of them is a professor at Oxford. Tariq Ramadan is his name. He's a rock star. Notre Dame, by the way, wanted to hire him. And it was during the Bush administration, and he had got some sort of, he'd given money off to some charitable organization, so they were curious about him and he didn't get in. That was changed afterwards, but then Oxford picked him up. So if you're at Oxford, you want to go to Notre Dame? Who wants to go to Notre Dame if you got a job at Oxford?
He's a Notre Dame graduate.
Yeah, I'm all in favor of Notre Dame. Three cheers for Notre Dame. Here's what Ramadan is doing. He's written a biography of Muhammad. He's written a whole series of very interesting books. He says the meaning of Sharia is not law. It means the way. Much softer term. And he says, who's going to be in charge of the interpretation of these ancient texts? In the Quran and in the Hadith and so on, which is the material relative to the life of Muhammad. He says, the experts have got to do this. So those of you who've been to seminary, it's the historical critical operation that's got to be done here. And you've got to figure out how to read these texts in their context, got to read them historically, we've got to read them accurately. And the goal there is to pull this away from the sort of like ordinary sort of imam, half-literate imam perhaps, who is simply pulling it off the internet or simply reading this on their own. So what you've got here is a very significant effort to provide a liberal version of Islam, where Islam is about the way, not necessarily Sharia law, where it's seen as having its own historical relativities with respect to women, with respect to democracy. And so I think the most important development that's going to take place over the next 20 to 30 years is actually the extent to which this will make progress. Now, I said to Lee coming down here, this is a Monday, so I'm an optimist. What I'll be on Tuesday, I'm not sure. But I'll finish this way. You Americans have an amazing culture. Now, you're very noisy. And around election time, you really get your underwear in a twist. You know, if you watch too much TV, it really sort of depresses you, right? But here's the interesting thing about you. You house train everybody who comes in. Now, forgive my rather graphic analogy. Take Roman Catholicism. Go down to Costa Rica. Just fly over to Costa Rica and see whether you can build a Methodist church. Find out what's going to happen. Yeah? Catholicism in much of Latin America is stuck. What happened to Catholicism in America? They're now running the Supreme Court. And American Catholics had to readjust. I mean, you do the same with Jews who come in, you do the same with Irish Methodists. We brought Methodism to America. Look at what you did with it. Made it the largest Protestant denomination in the United States in the 19th century. In other words, what I want to say to you is this, is that whatever fears we may have, right, and fears of terrorism are legitimate fears. There are terrorist cell groups in the United States, right? And I'm not a pacifist, so I'm very glad there's a thing called Homeland Security, and I'm very glad that there are people who are keeping an eye on all sorts of things, with all the risks that go with that. And that's why I don't trust lawyers, I don't trust politicians. I maybe would trust a Methodist, maybe. But you have a system whereby you keep an eye on things, and above all, what you have is you have an ethos in which you knock the rough edges off those who come here. And I'm going to make a prediction. I'm going to make a prediction that Reformed Islam is going to flourish in the United States. It's going to show up in religious studies departments. It's going to show up in legal circles, in places like Yale and elsewhere. And so while this is not an easy journey, my own view is that at the end of the day, it is some version of Reformed and liberal Islam that's going to emerge in the United States. I do not think you're going to be able to export this elsewhere, very limited degree. But I think as far as the United States is concerned, you have the resilience and you have this amazing culture, which in actual fact figures out a way to tame the more fanatical tendencies in the human spirit, and where you love theology, you know, and you'll argue about it. And so what's going to happen, in my judgment, is that that as Muslims assimilate in this country, in fact, it will become part of the American landscape. So there you go. There's my presentation on terrorism and Islam. And I'm open to questions, objections, or concerns at this stage. Over here. If you speak very clearly. That's a very good question. That's a very good question. The question is this. We may end up with a reformed and liberal version of Islam in the United States. I think the chances of that are pretty high. But what about the bigger international scene? Now, my jury is out on this, is what I would say. Come back to a theme I mentioned earlier. I speak as much as a layperson as I do as a theologian and philosopher. What happened in the modern period is that we thought we got rid of religion. And of course, when we got rid of religion, we got fascism and we got communism and we got some very, very nasty political systems, which killed a lot of people. And so we weren't quite sure where we were going, other than that I was taught religion's finished. But now it's back with a vengeance. And it's that's why what happens in mainstream Islam is going to be very important at this stage, and how they will handle the radicals in their midst. But I think we're going into a kind of prolonged period of almost like a Cold War. This is very vague and general at this stage. But I think the Christian tradition, I'll put it maybe this way, faces two very significant challenges that nobody anticipated. One was the arrival of militant atheism. Having been taught by the older nice atheists, I find the paranoic, nasty atheists, well, I could lose my religion and say nasty things about them, but I won't. But that's something that nobody was ready for. And our kids and grandchildren will have to deal with that. But the other thing that's emerged is rather than religion dying away, we've now got a form of religion with a potent, and I would say toxic, commitment to the intersection of religion and politics and war. And I think the next 20 years, that's going to be the front burner, one of the crucial front burner issues for the West. And overall, I'm an optimist about our resources and our resilience, but I think we're in for a long stretch. And so I think on the international sphere, they will never beat the West. No way. You've got, the technologically you're ahead of everybody. You can eavesdrop on everybody. That's a scary thing sometimes. My phone, by the way, was tapped when I was in Belfast by loyalist paramilitaries. Interesting. So to answer your question broadly, I think I would be very sober about the long-haul sort of global picture at that stage. And I think it's extremely important that there be a coalition between Western liberal democracies and both mainstream and reform Islam in order to actually contain what is a very potent, nasty version of Islam. So I'm hoping that that coalition will sort of work together and that we'll make it through over the next 30 years on this. Lee, do you want to... why don't you take care of this? Because I might blow... You all right, good man. Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you. You spoke of a minority report, okay? What concerns me is this. The Nazis were a minority in Germany and slew tens of millions. The communists were a minority in Russia and slew more tens of millions. I understand that radical Islam may be numerically a minority, but Nazism and communism, by the simple virtue of slaughter, rendered the majority a non-factor.
Now, is that a question or a comment?
Both.
No, that's very good. No, I love it. Actually, I totally agree with you. I agree with you. In fact, I said the problem with terrorist groups is they're minorities. 500 of them in the north of Ireland. That's not many people. They wreaked havoc. So that's the tricky part in all of this. That's the sobering element in all of this. And... which is what I'll put my point this way. This is not; they are not going to be defeated any day soon. And it is astonishing that there's not been another 9/11. If you think about it, so this is a time for what I would call persistent vigilance. And I think it's very important to have the resources in government and in the military arena that can take care of this. It took us 30 years in Ireland to get any kind of settlement, and it's still not over. I mean, it still rumbles on like the flu, bad 21-day flu that we've had recently. So I'm not disagreeing with you. My bigger picture is just two points. One is I think reformed and liberal Islam has a future, and I think it's particularly got a future in the United States because of your culture. And I think on the global area, we need to keep our wits about us, really need to keep our wits about us there. But I don't disagree with your point that a small group of people can do an awful lot of harm. Over here? Yes, sir.
By your definition of terrorist, ISIS would appear to fit that criteria. And I can see where their goal would be drive all non-Muslims from Muslim lands. What is their thinking when they turn on their own? They kill their fellow Shia Muslims.
Yes, that's a very good question. How shall I put this? They think they're all apostates. Now, there's a long tradition of this in Christianity as well, as you know. there are some people in Jesus' land don't think I'm a Christian. I'm not sure what First Baptist Church really thinks of me up in Dallas, but I love First Baptist people no matter what. They're very good tithers when they become United Methodists. But, they go back to this proposition, broadly speaking, they go back to this proposition that the earliest form of Muslim Islam is the true Islam. And what happens later is it gets corrupted. And this, of course, was a central argument in Protestantism against much of Catholicism. Not always in Protestantism. But that's the parallel here. And so the reason why they can slaughter and kill other Muslims is they don't think they're Muslims. They're corrupt, they're purely nominal, and they're not the real thing. Now, there is actually, believe it or not, in the radical form of Islam, there's also a quietist group, a quietist stream. The quietist stream says, you take care of your own spirituality. You take care of your own piety. You forget about all those apostates and let them go to hell where they belong. And you take care of your own soul and don't get into war with them. But the more radical, not the more radical forms, the more violent forms say, we got to take them out. And this in part was what there's enormous disappointment in the mid-20th century in places like Egypt and elsewhere. Because what the Egyptians and others adopted, they kept the facade of Islam and Muslim tradition, but underneath it there were radical secularists. There were hardline sort of socialists and Marxists of one sort or another, and they felt that was the way of the future. But of course that's failed, and that's left a vacuum for this other alternative to arise. So I think it's not difficult to understand why they turn on their own people.
Yes, just an observation. I had a Muslim boss for 2 years, and I was amazed how much he knew about our religion and how little I knew of his. And it was absolutely a fascinating experience because he was trying to convert me, of course, and I missed the opportunity to help him to lead to salvation. And so it's just, their indoctrination is such that they believe Muhammad is the final word. And there's so many intricacies of their religion that we just are not well equipped to absolutely that's one thing I've always felt bad about.
Yeah, that's a very good comment. Several things I could say. I want to be very careful where I say this, but I have a very close friend who works underground in Iran. And he said that if the government would open up and take the lid off, Iran would go Christian. And that in fact there's a lot of Islam which is simply purely nominal. I have a student right now who's from Iran. Actually, he found me on the internet at Perkins. And it was the only course in philosophy of religion that was an offer, and he showed up. So I quietly let him in without telling anybody. So don't you report this back to Perkins, right? And I talked to him about it, and he says the younger people in Iran, it's going to be very difficult to keep a lid on them. But of course, they are able to keep the lid on them. But your wider point is, these are really very gracious people, especially the Persians. Very, very gracious people. And I think part of the challenge for Christians that you've identified is, how are we going to be able to talk to those people when they think that we commit idolatry when we worship Jesus? And how are we going to deal with the objections that they have to the Trinity? I mean, I fear sometimes that many of our churches, and I take responsibility for this, we're theologically illiterate. We can't afford this for the future. Our children and grandchildren cannot afford this. My daughter has just come back from California. And, she's come back to the promised land. And one of the reasons she came back was her Muslim boyfriend wouldn't step up and hit the ball. So this is close to home. And he's a lovely fella. Now, he's a, you know, he's in America. So we're facing a whole new system of situation at that respect. And it's not that I don't want to get all in a lather to, you know, and get you all uptight about not knowing enough about your faith. But we're in for some interesting days up ahead. And I think we need to know our faith much better and why we believe what we believe and understand where they're coming from. By the way, one of the most interesting converts, if I can say this, forgive me for a second. I wish I had a board here, but his name is Laman Sanne, S-A-N-N-E-H. If again, a professor always gives you a reading assignment, S-A-N-N-E-H. He teaches at Yale. You want a story, all right? I'll hold your question. Laman was brought up as a Muslim without any knowledge of Christianity in a West African country, Gambia. At the age of 16, he was reading the Quran. Normal thing to do. He was reading the story of Jesus. And in the Quran, Jesus is not crucified. You can't crucify a prophet. God takes care of his own. And so what happened was, God stepped in and took somebody else, and miraculously, that person took the place of Jesus and got crucified. And Laman had a crisis of conscience. He said, something's not right here. So can you imagine what happened when he found a New Testament? He went up the road to the Methodist missionaries, and there was an Irishman there, or everywhere, called Stanley Whittington. And Stanley sent him home to read New Testament criticism and hitch Richard Niebuhr. He said this wasn't getting him very far, so he decided to go down to the Roman Catholic Church. And they went through a similar sort of situation. And eventually he says, you know, I'd like to be baptized. So the Catholics said, go up to the Methodists. We'll take their baptism. He thought, two for the price of one. By this time, it was an Englishman was there. And when he went to be baptized, he said to the fellow who was baptizing him, he said, the chap who was baptizing him, he said, we'll not tell anybody, because it would have been dangerous. Laman said, I want to tell the whole world. He ended up teaching at Harvard. He's now teaching at Yale. Recently, actually, gone back to the Roman Catholic Church and went back to Gambia to find the priest who wouldn't baptize him, who's now a bishop. And totally unrepentant about what he did. So anyway, there's a lot out there that we could cover. And one of the interesting things, however, the point I want to make in some respects is this, is that there's a lot of Muslim converts. And there are whole groups that have become Christian. And many of them are being converted through visions of Jesus. Now, this is a bit tough for Methodists to handle. Not an Irish one, you know, but so it's an extraordinarily interesting world. And so it's not just a matter of finding out about the beliefs of other people. It's a fascinating world out there. So I would recommend Laman Sané's autobiography. It's a book called From the Margins. And I would say it's almost close to Augustine's Confessions in terms of the sheer beauty of what he's done. And I don't give out compliments like that too often.
Well, Irishmen go to bed earlier.
Depends where we go after we leave here. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
How does Muslim idea of being humanist or even humanitarian compare with Methodist humanitarianism or perhaps Catholic humanitarianism?
Right. At a very functional, basic level, it's going to be the same. At the very functional basic level, it's going to be the same. you know, people are hungry, we're going to feed them. They have an enormous charitable organization. Part of the requirement of being a Muslim is you actually give money systematically as part of your duty. So I think at the humanitarian level, it will be, in terms of what actually gets done, a lot of it will be very similar. What will be different is the motivation. And a lot of Islam, a lot of Muslims do not really think about God as being the deep personal father who loves and cares for us. And I'm using that in a non-sexist way. They have a tremendous sense of God the All-Merciful, because they need that. But they're stuck on justification by grace through works. And you'll get in with the luggage if you behave yourself and pay your charitable taxes and go to Mecca, learn the Quran if you're young, and so on and so forth. So it is a kind of tough works righteousness at its core. And I think as far as Methodism is concerned, you know, it for us, it's grounded in a piety that is liberated from self-absorption, if I can put it that way. We don't always succeed in this respect. And I think, therefore, the fundamental motivation, you know, we love because he first loved us. That's a great text of Wesley's. And so Methodism is sort of like generated out of a deep encounter over the years with the living God for us and for our mothers and fathers in the faith. And that's what brought me to faith, by the way, if I may sort of finish off this part of the question. I brought up Protestant but not Christian. My father was killed in a very bad road accident when I was 3 and a half. I was such a tearaway, they sent me to school and I fell in love with the teacher and never left. And when I became, you know, when I was sort of like in my mid-teens, 15 or so, I thought, this going to church is for the birds. I don't believe any of this stuff. And anyway, God's not visible. If there's no visibility to God, there's no God. Aquinas, by the way, is this problem for those of you who've been to Perkins, but that's another issue. And I thought, you know, if I stay at home and quit, that's a big decision. Now, why did I think that? Because your guy like Marty up there, he's leaning up against the doorpost, every 3 months came to our house with the orphan money. It's the money that was picked up at the communion tables. And it was sent, we organized, you know, it was sent to Belfast and then sent out to my family. And these ministers would show up and they would have the orphan money. That's what got us our Christmas dinner. That's what put shoes on our feet. And when I was about to walk, I said, this is a big decision. And within 3 months, I found myself completely turned around, which I'll not bore you with here. So Methodism is driven by this sort of very natural sort of expressivism in which, well, of course we'll just get organized and get this taken care of and get to the people in need. And then what, for me, was the issue, they prayed for us. Good Lord. I remember going over one time, and afterwards I said to my mother, I said, who is he talking to? And she gave me a cuff in the ear. Now, I think there's a kind of spontaneity and generated by a life of grace and of the work of the Spirit within and the inner witness of the Holy Spirit that gives us, when we do our charitable work, we really wanted to give glory to God. It's not brownie points to get in with the luggage on the other side. You have a question, sir.
Yes, sir. Hello. Oh, there we are. If, as you said, terrorism and ISIS are minority part of Islam, what, in your opinion, would it take for the majority of Islam to do something in-house, short of, you know, raising arms to fight them, cut them off financially, cut them off, you know, in all that they do.
All right, I'm going to punt. This is above my pay grade. you know, I mean, my own view, I mean, broadly speaking, is that we need to use every morally approved strategy to defeat these people. And I think, you know, I'm just not going to be in a position to make good judgments about these matters. Here I agree with Wesley. I think, you know, our politicians, this is why we ought to pray for our politicians, this is why we ought to foster our children and grandchildren to become politicians. Seriously, seriously. Because they have to deal with information that we don't have. And they've got to make complicated judgment calls across the board, which, where they have access to the to basically to information of all sorts of various kinds of information, economic, military, and so on. And my view at this stage is that as a theologian, as a professor, I have got very limited view, very limited access to that. So I think this is where we need Christian politicians. And they're going to disagree with themselves and with each other and so on. That's good enough. So, but the broad thing is this. I mean, this is why I would not hesitate to use lethal force. This is why I am not a pacifist. I mean, personally, I'm not going to go out and kill anybody. You're okay. But I am not a pacifist. And the reason why I'm not a pacifist is because I do not think I can love my neighbor who's been slaughtered by people who are going to cut their throats and destroy them. I am not loving my neighbor if I just simply step aside and say, okay, I'll try other non-moral, non-lethal ways of dealing with them. Now, that's a big moral question, as you know. Now, I think we need to use every range of strategy and instruments available to us as a democratic people, and we need healthy conversation about that, and we need vigilance as far as our leaders are concerned. Power is a very potent thing, and you will use it against other people in ways that are not appropriate if you can get away with it sometimes. So a healthy democracy will argue about this in public all over the place. But my own view is the whole range of instruments available to a government ought to be deployed, up to and including lethal force. And whether then, you know, with the ISIS case, you know, how that's to be achieved, I'm going to leave that to the folk in the White House. This man belongs to my annual conference.
You say that the Muslims are, we understand salvation by grace through faith, but faith through grace. Isn't it inherently true that a religion of works righteousness is more susceptible to fanaticism than a religion of grace inherently?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. You know, because the crucial issue is that if you really believe in grace, you believe in a God who's a sort of a charge of things, and you're not. And you also believe that there's mercy. And you also believe, you know, you have enough trouble as it is without taking judgment and killing people into your own hands, broadly speaking. I mean, I have enough problems taking care of my own sins. I had a lot of them until I got sent to Texas. So I think your thesis, I mean, it would that requires a 30-page paper. I think it's a wonderful thesis that a religion of grace. Now you've got to watch it. There is going to be a downside. Some people said, you know, grace. Let's sin to our heart's content. You know that grace may abound. Somewhere, is that in the New Testament? I think it's somewhere in Romans. But I think in broad terms, you're dead right. And the fanaticism in the religious arena is driven by bigotry. It's driven by the conviction that you and your group have the access to the, and only you and your group have access to the truth about God. And further, that you can give God a hand in running the universe. And especially in getting rid of God's enemies. But, as I say, that's a 30-page paper, and after 8 o'clock, I charge overtime now.
I think it's a very good indicator of how engaging Dr. Abraham is that you extended his lecture a good 35 minutes beyond his hour. And so I appreciate your engagement, your involvement, and anticipate your return tomorrow night. We'll have dinner at 6, then have the lecture at 6:30, and we look forward to everyone's return and to how the musings of the mind focuses in on the topic for tomorrow.
Okay. I have no idea where I'm going.
So as you go forth in the evening, may the light of God's grace and goodness so shine on your pathway that you can walk and not stumble, and that His grace will lead you into His light of goodness, and you'll be filled with the love and spirit of Jesus Christ, so that all that you say and all that you do will be in keeping with His will and His purpose. Amen and amen. Amen.